I lay on my chest and I thought it best to pretend I was having an evening rest. I lay on my tum and I tried to hum, but nothing particular seemed to come. I lay on my tum and I tried to hum, but nothing particular seemed to come. My face was flat on the floor, and that is all very well for a acrobat, but it doesn't seem fair to a friendly bear to stiffen him out with a basket chair. The sort of scrooge which grows and grows is not too nice for his poor old nose, and the sort of squatch is much too much for his neck and his mouth and his ears and such.
Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Liminalist. This is The Liminalist, the podcast in between. You are now listening.
You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
I'm a bit disorganized right now.
I'm a little disorganized today as well.
Well, that's all right. We'll just improvise and be spontaneous. I was actually hoping to read your interview with Weird Days before as preparation for this, but then I found out it wasn't online. It's subscription only, so, and I couldn't find any other interviews with you guys, so seems like you don't do this very much. Is that right?
We don't do it. Well, I mean, if we do, I end up doing them because Caleb doesn't have any interest in that kind of, I don't know, contact.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of the things that has attracted me to Big Blood in a way, actually. I mean, we discovered your music through the Free Music Archive. It was when we were working on the Beyond Dirt project, and we were looking for music we could use, and my wife, she just came across your music very quickly. I can't remember what she searched for, but some specific term she put in there. I think it was country death or something, some weird combination of words, and Creeping Crazy Time came up, and it's still one of my favorites of your songs, and it was love at first listen. And then of course we very quickly discovered how little known you guys are, and it seems like how little concern you've had about actually becoming mainstream, and that it's actually quite hard to talk about because it seems as though it's sort of I don't know, it's almost like it just seems a bit weird, but it's just so rare nowadays that to find artists who are just focused on the creative process and really put very little into actually being discovered or being successful, quote unquote, in the usual sense. And I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I do feel that it gives the work a purity that it otherwise lacks. So that's kind of just one of the things I really respond to about your music, is it just seems to be all about the process and the creative process and the experience of it that you guys are having, and that really communicates in the music. It's like it's not I don't know what the word is for that, but it's not trying to be anything. It just seems very much about your own exploration of the form and of your own of yourselves, I guess. I'm not putting it very well, but anyway, I'll put it over to you and see what you have to say.
It's a huge compliment. I mean, all the things you just said are really... I'm so glad that someone feels that way about the music. And I agree that we didn't think about all of those systems because it just didn't seem like... It seemed like a waste of time, you know? I think people who are chasing it somewhere deep down know it's a waste of time, too, you know, to try and get yourself heard. And being well-known or not well-known is... It's totally inconsequential to making the music itself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't, you know, writers write because they have to say something, and you create because you have to get it out. But we have a system, and that system just happens to be, like, Caleb as a recording person, you know, the way he filters sound and hears things, and then my constant, well, both of us, like, writing a lot of music. In fits and spurts, you know.
When you say you have a system, I mean, is that it, what you just described, or is there more to it?
It's a system like we know we're going to play music, or we know that if I make a song up, he's going to record it, and that's it. Like, that will happen.
Right.
You end up, like, you know, 25 things, and some of them are, like, you know, 45 seconds, and some of them have created other things. They've spawned, like, 3 different songs, and some of them are failed and didn't work at all and got scrapped. And so that's the system. It's, like, very wide open, and there are no rules on the, like, what he's going to do or how I'm supposed to sound or what kind of music it's going to be or how long.
Right. And the songs sound to me very much like they're... partly improvised, but also like they're live. I mean, they don't actually sound like live songs because they sound very clear and well produced, but I get the impression that it's all happening at the same time rather than being mixed together. Is that right?
I mean, it really depends. I feel like Caleb's process of writing a song is very different than mine, in that he will, like, work on something. I mean, it ranges. Some things come to him really fast, and other things he works on for a long time, or records like 5 or 6 different ways, but you only get the one version on the CD, but he's got like 6 of them with different instrumentation and different interpretations. So his stuff's really not that improvised, but then in his recording process, he might add something. So it's like, usually the recording is, to me, like a painting. Like when Caleb works on the recording, like you might know the song in its infancy, but what he ends up doing to it becomes kind of, you know, like I said, a painting. Like all the elements come together, and he's got like blue in the background, and that blue is like a piano. Or I'm looking at your picture of the cat, and I'm like looking at the blue background, and the black cat in the front is the vocal. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Understand what I'm saying about the way he put songs together?
Well, somewhat. And he said to me in an email, it came up about synesthesia, that he's familiar with the experience of synesthesia and of all the senses blending together.
He experiences it on one level, but we can't really talk about it. I think we're not allowed to talk about Caleb.
Oh, that's part of that.
But yes, he does. He sees colors with songs. And I think my process, you know, in terms of improvisation, you know, I've been listening to the podcast, and I thought that the last 2 interviews were really, really awesome. And Caleb and I both liked the second interview with, was it George P. Hansen?
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Yeah.
And we've been talking about it a lot, and we like the way that the conversation took shape. And I feel like I got so much out of it. And I thought about it in terms of Big Blood and what we end up doing here. And I leave a lot of space, especially on songs like that were on the Wicked Hex, which you might, I don't know if you know that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have all your songs. They're all downloaded.
That one was like mostly unscripted kind of, and same with Water from the other, I think it's on the Wicked Hex too. that was like a touring set, and so I left it wide open. So every night I would like face the song and kind of have a general idea of the structure, but not really know like what I was going to sing or where the like crescendo was going to be, I guess, for lack of a better word. And it changed every night. And some nights it was great, and some nights it wasn't so great.
You mean when you were performing it, or when you were figuring it out?
Yeah, when we were performing it, because so much of the time I like the first thing that I do, and so the rest of the time I play the song, I'm always trying to do the first thing, just like the way I heard it the first time.
Right.
And you can't replicate things. They lose their freshness in the process of repeating. Unless you pin it down, and sometimes when you pin it down, you get it right. But sometimes when you pin it down, you get it wrong, and you close off different melodic ideas or the way of, like lyrics. Lyrics are so frustrating because they really pin you down. A word pins you down in meaning.
Yes, you're talking to a writer now, so...
Yes, so I have a fear of being pinned down in my meaning, in my artwork and in my musical process. So that's why I left those spaces open and why I still do sometimes. Or a lot of times I'll just record myself improvising and then I'll transcribe what I wrote and see if it makes sense and use that as a structure.
Structure and anti-structure.
So like being pinned down, and I think what is the neurotic and the downside of that fear of being pinned down is that, you know, you've already established yourself, you know, you already have an opinion, you already are somebody. So when you don't kind of take the, like, just, like, own it, then it does become a pointless circle of, like, hiding out, you know? And I do a lot of that. Like, I like to, and Caleb and I both, I think we both feel like it's our right to, like, make things and not put them out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, still a lot of things that we haven't put out, even though we've put out a lot of music. We just want to be able to have the process, and we have a really strong studio practice where we just, like, put one to bed, and then we start cranking whatever it is that we want to do that during that period of time. And that's when we get all of our stuff done. And I feel like it's a, Caleb and I are talking about it being a period of liminality because we're boundless. You know, we can do anything creative we want in that space of time.
Yeah.
And then it comes to an end because we have to go to bed. And the next day we have to get up and take Quinn to school and, you know, make her lunch and then go to work and come home. But we know it's coming up. We know this, like, empty space, this, like, cloud nine is, like, happening between, you know, 9:30 and 2 a.m.
It's reminding me of something my wife has brought up a lot in terms of relationships, that with a couple, we're always negotiating between space and togetherness. Like, we want space, but we also want the experience of togetherness, and it's like there's this razor's edge, sweet spot, where it's exactly, the balance is exactly right. And of course, it's almost impossible to even find that balance, much less maintain it. So, I mean, that's experience in a relationship, but it's occurring to me as maybe there's a parallel in terms of being a creative person, that we want the experience of being in the process and being in that liminal space where there's no need for structures and definitions or being pinned down or turning it into a product, because that's where the creativity flows. But we don't want to create in a vacuum. I mean, I'm speaking for myself, and I presume it's true for you because you do perform and you do put the music out there. We want the echo. We want to know that what we've discovered in ourselves and expressed in that liminal space where maybe there is no fear, just the excitement of the expression, we want to then know that it will be received and have the experience of it being received by taking it into the world and letting the others see it. And for me, at least, that there's anxiety in that, for sure. But
excitement.
It's a bit of an expression my wife uses, rubber meets road. I mean, one can be as creative as one wants in isolation, but it's never actually tested. It's like a communication. You can send signals out all you want, but until you get a signal back, you don't know for sure that you've even expressed something.
It's true. That's why the relationships are, I think, the ultimate, I mean, a marriage of any sort, whether it be a friendship type marriage or, I don't know, family. But when you have a relationship where you're trying to openly communicate with another person, it's challenging, and you grow so much more than all that time that you spend alone, like fretting or worrying or trying to analyze and pick things apart.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously having kids is just like blows it even further. You know, the whole human experience becomes just a really, you know, that space that you're talking about where the relationship has like its sweet spot. It kind of grows and it shrinks. It's weird. It's like, it actually grows a lot with our family, but I think for a lot of people, parenting is like just a terribly huge responsibility in today's world. And I think that's why people are having less kids, because it's such a mind. It's so heavy, you know. You want to do it right. People who want to be like good parents, you want to do it right, and whatever that means, good parents. But, you know,
mm-hmm.
That is like a liminal space, because you seriously have no clue what to do almost all the time.
Right.
And you have to make a choice. And I mean, sometimes you do know what you're doing, But there are plenty of times where there is no clear path for what to choose. And this is like your child, you know?
Mm.
So you kind of can't get caught up in every single one. You have to, like, see the structure, see that they need structure, and try and implement, like, some really important things, and then just let everything else slide.
Mm.
Because it's that hard to, like, manage your own life. So if you add that into, like, family and, you know, being in a band and trying to get, like, I don't know, trying to get recognition, the only way you can do that in the music is by touring. And touring is not for a family. Not for a family with young kids, you know? And that's how we started this whole project. You know, we are at our 8-year anniversary. Quinn is 8 years old. And we started Big Blood when she was born because we knew we had to set into place a place for our creative, for our music to go, for the music we knew we had, like, inside of us. And a way to commit to say, like, we're not going to lose this side of our, everyone saying things are going to change and you're going to be parents and you're never going to be able to do all this and just you wait. And they were all right. But, you know, we've made changes in our lives to support that creative time. And it's really paid off, I believe, because I still feel like we have a relationship with each other that is a friendship. And we love our daughter and we're not sick of hanging out with her at all. Not that she doesn't have her good days and her bad days, but I don't want to run away from the life that we made. And I think it's a common thing for people to feel like that right now.
To want to run away.
From anything, yet to escape. I mean, it's so, and it's being pushed on us to want to escape, like, you know, Netflix binging, I don't know, Facebook time, you know, all the like pop songs on the radio, you know, it's all like just for tonight and, you know, just don't, you know, don't live for tomorrow, like live for right now. And even like a mom of two kids can be like, I gotta get out of here. I want to be in a liminal space where I'm not having to be pinned down by a child or by a husband or, you know, by my boss.
I wonder if people are actually fleeing the liminal space at the same time as what you're describing, because they feel trapped and imprisoned by social responsibilities and obligations. That's fairly common, but I think it relates to when we flee, we're fleeing something inside us, primarily, don't you think?
I do, and I wonder, though, if it's not that liminoid thing, like, with the fraternity rituals, and, like, if drug-taking, which I think is really prevalent among culture, like, in a really, like, people hide a lot of things, you know, it's like this unspoken thing, the prescription drugs that people are on, and then, you know, just like having to regulate your brain chemistry now is, I believe it, you know, I believe it has to happen. It's a different time than it was, I don't know, in the 1820s or the 1600s or the 1400s. So it just changes things when you have people taking drugs in order to get to a liminal space. So it seems like a false way to escape and become weightless or become transitional or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, it's just we're going off in many different directions now. So what's occurring to me is that it may have to do with how identity is a social thing. It's a social construct. We basically develop an identity in relation to society, family, first of all. But, you know, for thousands, maybe millions of years, that was biologically, I mean, it related to our biological place in a tribe, in a very small local environment. But in the last, just in the last few decades, really, the global village has come into play where our social group is the whole planet, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so to actually find an identity in that, that is really that functions, is perhaps impossible even, but certainly it's getting harder and harder to have a sense of who we are in relation to others, because the others that we interact with are a legion. Yeah, if you include Facebook and TV, you know, and movies and just all these different faces and people that we're actually becoming aware of. Yeah, I think that's the information overload, specifically how that impacts our sense of who we are. And maybe this relates to the space and togetherness in a relationship, how being an artist, being creative, and wanting to communicate with an audience, maybe this in itself is like a quest for identity.
Did that not make any sense?
Yeah, it did. I was it was kind of what you're expressing is kind of how I experience your music. It's very visceral, I find, your music and your expression. It's a very visceral expression, which makes the name Big Blood perfect. And another thing perhaps related is that I feel your music, or I was thinking anyway when you were saying this, that it's very personal, and yet it seems very impersonal at the same time. Like, I don't have any sense of what your songs are about, mostly. I don't really have any sense of you or Caleb as people. I mean, as, you know, in a personal sense, like, your personalities. And yet, it's obviously so very, very personal, in a sense it's so very unique and clear an expression of who you are. It doesn't seem to be filtered through genres or through attempts to create something that would be acceptable or accessible. It just seems very raw in that sense, almost primal. So there's something very, for me, that's very delightful, but it's also kind of mysterious because it's personal and not personal at the same time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you. That's great too. I love that. I don't want to, you know, Quinn was on the radio the other day and she was complaining about pop music to the DJ and how it's all about love and it's all about breakups. That's what she said. It's all about breakups. She's like, stop singing about your emotions all the time. When you're making music, there's no point in even, I don't know, thinking about how anything will be perceived. I mean, I think that's an important thing to, like, a frame of mind to shift into when you're being creative, because then you can really be yourself. And with recording, when you're yourself, I feel like you can create an intimate space, or you can create, like with sound and words, you can create a truth, like kind of an undeniable truth. Like, someone might not like your music, but they'll hear it and they'll be like, okay, it's got something, you know, or it doesn't have anything. So for myself, you know, a lot of times I'm just like groping in a fog, like all the time. Like, I leave cabinet doors open and I'm just like, there's like shit sitting in the middle of the floor, you know, like I'm like moving a million miles an hour, multitasking all the time. So I might sit down and find a melody and I'll just know it sounds right, but I won't know what the words will be. And so maybe I'll never write words for it and I'll always make them up. Oh, play together, me and Caleb and Sean, I mean, I sometimes I don't even exist body-wise. I'm just, like, floating out there, and the music sounds so good. And, you know, even though now I'm playing drums and I'm connected, like, by feet and sticks to like, the music, I still feel like I can get lost in it, especially if I get to sing, you know, if it's one of my songs. But Caleb's songs, too, even though I have to stick to words and, you know, the melodies and the changes are coming up, and I have to pay attention, I can still get lost in the music. I don't think we're in danger of getting big, and I don't fear the music industry at all. I just feel like it's not going to be my reality. Mm. You know, like, I don't want to be, I don't need to be that performer, you know, and I don't fit the bill, and I'm happy to not fit the bill. Like, I love where we're at right now. I love the space that we exist in. I feel like someone was talking to me about Big Blood, and I'm like, we've made it, you know, mm-hmm. Like, we make our own CDs and we have a really flexible work schedule, and we hang out with our family and our friends, and we, like, have, to me, what is like a balanced life. And we're lucky enough. I mean, we live in a beautiful place and we have a lot of support, and I just feel like, you know, we got it good. Like, I'm not going to mess with this in any way. I come from a punk background where real people play instruments and they're not perfect. And you're just there to, like, dance or feel it or hear the music through your body. And really the best things that I like music-wise and art-wise are all things by people I know.
Yeah, I think this is something I'm trying to get to also. It's really nice to hear you say this, by the way, about, like, you found this own sweet spot for yourself as performers, and nothing needs to change that. There's no need to try and reach beyond that. When self-expression or exploration of one's own inner world by expressing it, bringing up the unconscious to find out what's there, that whole process, which is the essence of creativity, in my opinion, when that seeps over into becoming a culture maker, and becomes actually, capital. You know, becomes a currency. You become, I mean, think of Paul Van Gogh, you know. He had no idea. Like, he spent his whole life in that process, and I guess maybe it destroyed him in the end, the frustration of not being able to reach anyone at all. I don't know. But now, of course, Van Gogh is a commodity. Or Kafka would be another example. It's a very strange thing in cases like that, but perhaps it's possible to argue even that the purity of that work was dependent on those individuals actually not becoming culture makers in their own time, because the process was pure. So where am I going with this? I'm not sure exactly, but...
Well, yeah. I would like to say that about, you know, I don't think that their isolation, you know, was versus being culture makers, because I mean, I think about this a lot, and I think about the archetype of the artist and the writer is, like, self-destructive, or, you know, an asshole, or, you know, just, like, unbearable but respected, like this weird Hemingway kind of behavior. And I really don't believe that it has to be like that. I think we've been fed that, and I want to believe that artists also want to maintain some kind of balance, like that you can still be a good artist and not have to be like this tortured thing. But in a way, you know, I mean, we all feel tortured, you know, regardless of our circumstance, like that sadness and despair that you can relate to Edgar Allan Poe, or I don't know, like, I keep thinking about Eric Satie and how he died, you know, kind of similar, like his work is totally celebrated now, but in his lifetime it wasn't, it didn't come to that kind of conclusion. And now, I mean, it's like history is going to make money off of you if your work is, if your work can stand the test of time. So why not enjoy your life while you have it? Because you know, you can be miserable or you cannot be miserable and still try to be creative, you know, and maybe your work, it will not be as powerful. I don't know. You know,
I agree with this. I don't think it's about being miserable, but I think that the isolation is a part of it. I think one can be isolated without being miserable would be the middle ground here. And the isolation, you know, to be alone in the root is Sol anyway, the sun, like a star is isolate. And the exploration inward, the journey inward, is by definition a solitary one. Like, we can't take anyone with us on the inner journey into our unconsciousness. This is when we fall asleep at night, we do it alone. So, but there is, I mean, that is a very rich and, as you know, it's a delightful process, and to discover that we're not actually alone, like our inner world is populated in some sense, mysteriously. Yeah. I would agree that doesn't have to be tormenting. The torment for me is the world's indifference, and you know, to go inward and have the delight of discovering these things and then bringing them out, and then to find that the world is indifferent to what I bring out. Whoops, I think we lost a connection. Can you still hear me?
Oh, I hear you now.
Oh, what was the last thing you heard?
I heard that you said something really good, and I was thinking about it.
That helps.
Yeah. It was about the world.
The world's indifference.
Yes, the world's indifference, yes. I mean, yes, but... And I totally agree with you. I feel like that's a really good way to put it. In some ways, that says it all, and in other ways, it simplifies, like, all of the interactions that we have, and how those interactions, I think... I just think about isolation. Currently, I think about isolation and isolating myself and being alone as a luxury, because I have so many demands on me as a partner, as a mom, as a woman, as a daughter, as a, you know, friend and family member, that when I'm alone and I get to think about these things and look at the problems and turn them and then come out of it, you know, go into that creative space, I feel very thankful that I get to be in that space to make these things. And sometimes in that space is when I get the most, like, upset about injustices, or, you know, like how stupid people can be or mean. And, you know, and then again, I have the luxury of turning to these books that I've read or found or been given that help me believe in myself or in human beings. The world's indifference is a problem, and I feel like the liminal space is a luxurious place in my mind to be. And it was funny that George P. Hansen was talking about it as a kind of a terrible place. You know, how it can be a very terrible time historically, like in a historical context, and I believe that's true. And I believe we do try to hold on to rituals, and that right now we really don't have very much, because we're not an overtly religious society, as Americans anyway. And it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't believe in that. I was raised Catholic, and I don't want to, like, take my daughter to Catholic church, but I think that when we have things to believe in, it's very important.
Well, one of the things I was trying to express to George P. Hansen, which I didn't succeed, I think, was that the difference between an individual experience of liminality and a collective one and a group one, and as consciousness, if we experience ourselves as consciousness, which in my understanding, my experience, that's all we can experience, really, is that there is consciousness here. And that is a perpetually, eternally liminal state. Like, I can't be sure that what I think just happened really did happen, and I have no idea what's going to happen next. I just create this semblance of a narrative of continuity that from which comes a sense of identity, and vice versa. It's kind of a chicken or an egg thing, but it feels to me that we impose structure onto maybe it's not chaotic but infinite experience in order to draw coherence out of it. And maybe that is the creative process too. We're plumbing the depths of the unconscious and bringing up all of this lead and reducing it down through the focus of our attention to one little nugget of gold, and then presenting the gold to the world and seeing if it recognizes the value of it or whether it doesn't. I'm just kind of reassociating now, but wasn't going to a point, or maybe it started with a point. Oh yeah, you were talking about the discomfort of the liminal and the need for beliefs. And
well, and also they don't have, like, you know, what you're talking about of plumbing the depth, that's like, to me, that's a writer's job, you know, that's like an artist's job.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just don't exist in that space where, but then you know, to go back to something you were talking about earlier, where there's like a growing frame of mind that everyone can be creative. Like, don't you think that's like something acceptable that's like spreading, where everyone's an artist, and, you know, because of technology and also kind of the breakdown of the hierarchy of like mid-level things, mm-hmm. generalization, that there's more space for everyone to be everything. Like, so many musicians, and maybe they're all not getting heard, but there are a lot of people that are in bands, and there are a lot of people that make art.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting subject to me, because I think it's like so many of the things going on, it has its good points and bad points, to quote one of my favorite songs. Because I see art, well, I guess there's two ways I could say I see it. One is as a craft, and then I take it very seriously. Like, I've spent decades learning to write and perfecting this craft, just as a plumber or a carpenter would do so, and I feel that, you know, I've got good at it, and now I can, what I do has value, just as a good carpenter who's done all the training builds a table. It has value as a work, you know, as a constructed work, if you will, and that's something that not anyone can do. But then on the other hand, the way I see art is not mutually exclusive, but is, as we've been talking about, is as an exploration of one's inner world and an expression of what one has within, and trying to sort of overcome inhibitions through that process to discover more of what we have within us by expressing it. And I think we only discover what's within us by expressing it. Just, you know, we can't go to the unconscious. The unconscious has to come to us, in a sense, has to come out of us, and then, oh wow, I didn't know I had that in me. And that is absolutely not only what everyone can do, but I think what everyone must do. So I feel very strongly that, and bring back to this point about liminality and the chaos it brings about socially, I think that the only solution to that is for individuals to become more and more comfortable within, or accepting of, an inner experience of liminality, of not knowing, instead of constantly trying, you know, grasping for structures, trying to create new structures before its time, or trying to shore up the old ones that are crumbling, that need to crumble, you know, that constant grasping. And that was what I was getting at before when you were talking about housewives who want to run away, or whoever, that I feel it's partly that because they're feeling the inner chaos, they want to escape the geographical cure, right? They want to escape the old structures and enter into some new structure, whereas really it's our inner, the degree to which we can just be in whatever's happening and accept our own inner chaos and our own inner powerlessness. That seems to me the only place that real change can happen.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. I think that I can't help but think about, you know, the mother whose inner life and external and actual real life is like kind of under siege, you know, which I think a lot of women are experiencing that in the world. And there's a quote from one of the Alice Walker books about how this guy was talking about, you know, it was like female genital mutilation in Africa, which I'm not laughing about. I'm just, it's just, it just seems like such a horrible thing.
Yeah, it's, sorry to interrupt, but it's going on in England now as well. It's all over. It's like millions of women in England, if you can believe that.
This man who was part of, you know, one of the tribes and had gone through his own version of it by an aunt cutting his face. So he had this really extreme scar on his face. And he was saying that if all the world's women were comfortable, the world would be comfortable. If women were comfortable, the world would be a comfortable place. Hmm. And I really believe that that is true. And I think that if women had more of that space to be creative, to feel that they even had the space and time to think like that, or took that space. And, you know, not just thinking about myself, because I have that ability, you know, but then once you get that ability and that freedom, that you actually enjoy it, because I think there's a lot of fear in that space. And that's why, you know, like George P. Hansen was saying that, you know, I think it was him that was saying about Nazi Germany, like coming up through that liminal space. And I think that that's what that fear of not knowing causes you to adhere to a structure that maybe is not true.
There's a writer called Lloyd DeMaus who is doing some very interesting work. It's a psychological view of history. And he wrote a book called Emotional Life of Nations. And his view is that, and I'm not quoting directly, but I'm pretty sure this is accurate, that the only thing that will really change things at a social level relates to how mothers raise their children. And that because of the accumulated trauma over the millennia, you know, children who are traumatized grow up to be parents who are, you know, don't know how to parent their children. And essentially, like, for a mother, when a mother has a child, her own trauma, this is true for the father, but it's more critical with the mother because she's, you know, more involved, obviously, in those the first most formative months and years. Whatever trauma that the mother had in her own childhood gets re-triggered by having an infant, because she's psychically connected to the child, and so it's really difficult for the mother not to be reactive to the child. And when the mother's reactive, that of course passes the trauma on to the child. And so this is his view of what leads to all of this, you know, the social disorder and the chaos and the crime and the perversion, you know, all the atrocities can all be traced back to these formative periods in our lives as children. And so his view is that for mothers to have a space in which they feel absolutely safe and taken care of, because it primarily comes down to the husband, but on a larger scale to the whole society, to create this space for the mother, so that the mother won't be so reactive. She will feel safe, she will feel she has space to really just be herself, and these feelings will still be triggered in her by the child, but she will manage just to have enough, whatever that mysterious quality is, not to react, so then it doesn't perpetuate the trauma, and that this would bring about incremental change that was actually a real change within, you know, at a social level.
Right. I mean, I think that can be, I think it can be at least a goal that's closer if, you know, providing food for your children or a house, like dependable shelter, if those things become, you know, they're not a constant, if they're not a constant worry, then you have the space to be creative. You know, like once I can take care of my immediate people and just know that I'm loved and that I love, then I feel like I do have the space to do that. And I wish that people experience real love in their lifetime, but I believe it was like a Native American saying that it takes like 3 or 4 generations to undo the violence that might have happened in that one generation. And we've not even come close to being able to have a cycle like that.
Right.
Much less the abusive cycle, which is perpetuated by all kinds of minutiae in the society, you know, or within the family unit. You know, American families are not positive families. In my mind, like being a person who lives within the United States, you know, where like we all like can't stand our parents and, you know, we just want to have fun, like whatever. I mean, that's a stereotype, but then you think about it and there is a lot of dysfunction in the American familial society. And I believe it's because, you know, we're all immigrants from another country starting over. So our history is very short and we have to constantly reinvent. And so we can come up with new things and maybe produce artists or whatever. I can't even believe that America would take credit for the artists that have come out of the country, because the credit is due to the artists themselves, you know, not to the country that they were in. They managed to survive, and that's amazing. Oh, hey.
Uh-huh.
Hey. I'm Skyping. I'm on a Skype call. I'll be done in just a second, okay?
I got 2 ridiculous books.
Awesome.
It's called The Book with No...
Can you say hi to Jason? There's no video. It's just his voice.
Who's Jason?
He's a person that we know. He likes Big Blood, and he's heard some of your songs. And
can I read him the story?
He lives in Canada. You'd have to
ask. Yes, you can.
Okay.
Native American generation trauma.
Yeah.
We went from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Yes. And you know, parenting is ridiculous and being a mother is ridiculous and the most awesome responsibility. And giving birth too. I mean, just the fact that females can, that have that possibility, I think that just really, that has really pissed off men for generations. And so
really?
They've had to make movies like Fitzcarraldo in order to like have their own birth, and they've pulled a boat over a mountain, or they've built the Empire State Building or bridges.
And there's a very different thing I'm imagining to create life out of one's own body, so that life is actually growing inside one, which is kind of ironic that in sci-fi that's often depicted as a nightmare scenario, right? Possession by the alien other.
It is a lot like being possessed by an alien, though.
Well, I was just thinking that, because it's the opposite of egotism. Not that mothers can't be egotists and have children for all the wrong reasons, but at a biological level, it seems like if you're giving up your body to another as a host for another, that really is giving up one's life, potentially, for another.
Yeah, and you know, parenting or having a kid really brings out the crazy in people, just as it brings out the beautiful and... you know, and the worst and the best. I mean, it's just, it's like you, like, tripping all the time because you have, you know, it's like the scariest thing ever. And then you, like, kind of, and then you kind of get used to it. You get used to how intense it is to be a parent. Don't you think we'll be better to human beings once the aliens land? Because then we'll all be human beings, and they'll be the aliens.
Yeah, but then we'll probably start persecuting the aliens from like intergalactic traumas.
But we'll have to like each other better, you know? The other will have to show up in order for us to love the familiar.
Yeah, well, I think some of us are the aliens, however. I think we're already here. Yeah.
That's interesting. I like that.
going back to Big Blood, that's perhaps what I respond to in the music, is the sense that you're really enjoying what you're doing, and so it's what's being communicated, and it's what I aspire to with writing as well, is to be embodied, to actually for it to be an embodied expression and not just a mental or intellectual one or a formal one, the real substance of soul, to communicate that's a universal message, I think, and I think that does transcend the form or the style of the content, just fumbling with words because they're so ephemeral, but soul-to-soul connection that can happen through creative expression, because it's an individual connecting to his or her own soul. It's an expression of that experience, and then the audience, the recipient, can then have that experience of somebody else doing it, and then it's like it will echo inward, and they can then have the experience of connecting to their own inner essence.
Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, just that what happens in the playing is very exciting to me, and I relate it to like something that Miles Davis said about someone was asking him to like go back and talk about Kind of Blue, and he was doing this like 80s rap synth stuff that people were not responding well to. And he was like, I can't look back. I can only do the now, you know, like that's what's important to me. Like, I'm really excited about what I'm doing right now, and that's what I'm doing. So that's kind of how it feels like when we're in the room playing or when we're recording.
Didn't Miles Davis say, and I'm not a fan, I don't even know his music, but I think I saw it in a TV show recently. Didn't he say, don't play what's there, play what isn't there?
I don't know, but that's some liminal thinking, don't you think?
Yeah.
And I feel a lot of times, and I don't mean to sound like I don't presume to really be able to get to this, but I do strive to be kind of a vessel. And that's what getting to that liminal space is like, because you kind of don't know what you're doing or what you're saying, but you're feeling. But it's not like an out of control emotion. It's just like a channel is open, and you hold on to it for as long as you can. You know, it's kind of like walking a tightrope, and that's why I think it's going back to George P. Hansen. It's terrible and exciting all at once, because you can cross the tightrope. It will have a beginning and an end. But what you do while you're there, you know, who knows? You could fall off, or you could really, you know, save it at that last second. And, you know, the failure is part of the learning experience. And I think there should be a balance somewhere in there. I do feel like in music, Caleb has perfected that balance with the way that Big Blood sounds, and I can't take any responsibility for that. I mean, I do four track and do my own stuff, but he paints with the brush over everything and turns it into something that I really like the sound of. But I couldn't tell you, you know, how to get that or how he made that sound the way it is.
And he's not talented.
Well, he works with all kinds of people. You know, people seek him out and ask, you know, can you give us that sound? You know, and he tries, but I think that sometimes people want the polish. They can't handle it, because you have to really let it all hang out.
Right.
And I've just learned to know that it's worth the risk, because it does me no good to hide behind artifice. In the end, I don't like it, and I get bored of it really quickly.
So is there a new Big Blood song on their way?
Yeah, actually, we just put a blog post up today.
to let people know that we have two albums right now to celebrate our 8-year anniversary, Double Days 1 and 2.
Will these also be linked to the Big Blog?
Yeah.
Big Blog page?
Yeah, if you go to the blog, the Don't Trust the Ruin blogspot, that's where all the links go then to the FMA, to the Free Music Archives, and then you can listen to all of it. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed the other two podcasts, and I'm thinking of writing George P. Hansen and telling him.
Please do, yeah. Yeah, please do, because you heard the podcast. He's been skeptical about whether he'd managed to communicate what he wanted to communicate.
Well, because it was a real conversation, I think it's hard to judge, and he probably had some expectations. He seems like a person who likes structure, so... Yeah.
Quinn being on the radio, I was on the radio when I was about 8, talking about books, because my parents ran a children's bookshop, uh-huh. And so they were interviewed about that, and they brought me along to have the Charles View, and so that was my first ever radio appearance, was about the same age as Quinn.
That's where it all began.
Yeah, apparently. I actually began before that, because I recorded my own hums of poo with a tape recorder. I went off one day with the book and said, I'm going to do this. And I still have that recording, actually.
That's awesome. We should hear that. We should hear that at some point.
It should be incorporated into a podcast.
I think so.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, maybe you can make a Big Blood song.
It should be at the beginning of every podcast.
Yeah.
Some snippet. Maybe you keep us hanging on. You like it's a serial, every we get to read a little further with you every podcast.
Thank you.
like no fun to have someone read you a book with no pictures? It probably seems boring and serious, except here is how books work. Everything the words say, the person reading the book has to say, no matter what. That's the deal, that's the rule. So that means even if the words say blurf, wait, what? That doesn't even mean anything. Blurf, wait a second, what? This isn't the kind of book I wanted to read, and I have to say every word the book says. Uh-oh. Glug, glug, my face is a bug. I eat ants for breakfast right off the rug. What? And this kid is the smartest kid too, because this kid chooses the book even though it has no pictures, because kids know this is the book that makes grown-ups say, have to say silly things. And makes me sound like... Oh no, oh no. Baroob, 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 boing, boing, blaggity, 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 bloobity, bloop, blibbity, beep, bop. I'm a monkey who taught myself to read. And I'm not a monkey. And now I'm reading you this book with my monkey mouth in my monkey voice. That's not true, I'm not a monkey. Yes, I am a monkey. Also, I'm a robot monkey. What?
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world came tumbling down.
I want your fireman, said to monkey, I want your prey. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Out here comes the monkey. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling.